some of you are aware that I enjoy satire. In fact, if you were at the open mic event, you'll remember that I had mentioned I rather enjoy The Simpsons for that reason, that animated show that's been going on for forever. And in particular, when they would satirize the church in The Simpsons, when Reverend Lovejoy and Ned Flanders would be doing their thing, I always try to pay attention. You see, this is the thing about satire, is it's making fun of something in order to make a point. And so any time, in The Simpsons, for example, the church is being made fun of, that makes me think, should we be being made fun of for that reason, whatever it is? Because sometimes we just don't recognize what we're doing or saying, and we need someone to take a satirical approach to have us pay attention and think, maybe they're onto something there, right? Well, there's another source of satire that's been kind of fun that I've heard about. It's a website, a blog, really. It's called StuffWhitePeopleLike.com. And it came out back in 2008. A guy named Christian Lander wrote this, and this is what he says on the About page of his blog. This is a scientific approach to highlight and explain stuff white people like. They are pretty predictable. So the satire begins with the first post being that white people love coffee, is what he says. There is no doubt that white people love coffee. Yes, it's true that Asians like iced coffee and people of all races enjoy it, but I promise you that the first person at your school to drink coffee was a white person. You could kind of tell they didn't enjoy it, but they did it anyways until they liked it, like cigarettes. White people all need Starbucks and Second Cup. They're also fond of saying, "You do not want to see me before I have my morning coffee." He does go a little bit more pointedly to some other posts. Here's one. There are a few things white people love more than being offended. Naturally, white people do not get offended by statements directed at white people. In fact, they don't even have a problem making offensive statements about other white people. As a rule, white people strongly prefer to get offended on behalf of other people. It's also valuable to know that white people spend a significant portion of their time preparing for the moment when they will be offended. They will read magazines and books and watch documentaries, all in hopes that one day they will encounter a person who will say something offensive. When this happens, they can leap into action with quotes, statistics, and historical examples. Once they have finished lecturing another white person, for example, about how it's wrong to use the term black instead of African American, they can sit back and relax in the knowledge that they have made a difference. One other one that is rather pointed is this. An interesting fact about white people is that they firmly believe that all of the world's problems can be solved through awareness. Meaning the process of making other people aware of problems, and then magically someone else like the government will fix it. This belief allows them to feel that sweet self-satisfaction without actually having to solve anything or face any difficult challenges. Because the only challenge of raising awareness is people not being aware. In a worst-case scenario, if you fail, someone doesn't know about the problem. End of story. What makes this even more appealing for white people is that you can raise awareness through expensive dinners, parties, marathons, selling t-shirts, fashion shows, concerts, eating at restaurants, and bracelets. In other words, white people just have to keep doing stuff they like, except now they can feel better about making a difference. Raising awareness is also awesome because once you raise awareness to an acceptable arbitrary level, you can just back off and say, "Bam, did my part. Now it's your turn. Fix it." I didn't get many laughs at the 8 o'clock service either. Maybe satire isn't for everybody. But there is that little biting tone for sure, but it's making a point that kind of makes us feel a little uncomfortable, like it's kind of hitting a little bit close to home, isn't it? Well, yes, perhaps it is. And if you've been doing the homework I suggested you ought to do for this series that we're going through in Easter, you will have been reading through the letter of 1 John once or twice or three or four times by now, and chances are you've encountered some rather biting words in 1 John as well. Now, I can't say that 1 John, the letter being written by this pastor taking care of a troubled congregation, is necessarily using satire per se. But nevertheless, some of the things that he's saying are trying to cut through the haze to get to the bottom line about what really ought to be. Now, one of the things that he said, we read in this first passage. In fact, those first couple of sentences might have kind of struck you as like, whoa, I'm kind of taken aback by that. Here's what he had said. He said, "We know that we have passed from death to life because we love one another." So that in itself is already kind of arresting. Passing from death to life. Like, what's he talking about here? And of course, he's talking about this full and complete life. That's what eternal life is meant. That's what it means in the Bible. And he says that we know that this has begun, that this process has happened because we love one another. And he says, whoever does not love abides in death. Which sounds a little harsh. But what he's trying to do is grab our attention. Look it. This loving one another is so very, very important. In fact, it is absolutely vital. Now, it's important for us to remember that this letter that's being written is a letter that's being written in-house. It's being written to people who are part of this congregation, part of the church. It's written to a particular audience, this closed group, if you will, these people that are part of this church. Whatever John is saying in this letter is being directed towards this congregation. He's trying to keep intact and trying to avoid there being another breakaway group from happening again. And for where there are tensions within, he's trying to keep them all together. So even though some of the things he says might seem to have an application outside the church, and it might very well do so, that's not his primary intent. His focus is on the life within the group. And so he's telling this particular group, guys, you say that you're part of the family of God. You say that you're followers of Christ. If you do not love, you're abiding in death. You're saying that you're part of the giver of life, but if you're not loving one another, you're abiding in death. He goes on and says this, all who hate a brother or sister are murderers, and you know that murderers do not have eternal life abiding in him. And the audience is supposed to sit up and take notice and say, what are you saying? And of course, when he says brother or sister, he's talking about fellow Christians, people within the congregation, people within the church. We're not even worrying about loving our enemies. That's not even part of the package right now. He's talking about brothers or sisters. And of course, he's not using language that he's just created. Here we have John not referring back to the Gospel of John, but back to the Gospel of Matthew, actually. Because in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, Jesus said, you have heard that it was said, do not murder. But I tell you, anybody who hates his brother has murdered him in his heart. So the writer here is simply referring back to stuff Jesus had said. He said, we have to take this seriously. And so with this biting language, he goes on in a bit of a satirical way. And he says, how does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help? How can you say that you have the love of God in you if you're not prepared to extend a hand to a brother or sister in need? This is all encapsulated by what he already says describes for us the love that we're supposed to be acting in. He says, here is how we know what love is. Jesus laid down his life for us. And we are to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. This is what John is calling the congregation to. This is the very high calling, the great challenge that he is laying out to this congregation. And we, by extension, being part of that great tradition that began then, and understand that this would be the kind of thing he's saying to congregations like ours. That we are to love one another with the same kind of love that Jesus loved us. Now, what was that love like? Well, John summarized it. Jesus laid down his life for us, and we get that. But also recall that first Maundy Thursday. And if we went to the Maundy Thursday service, and at some point in Holy Week, you would have heard it rehearsed again, that Jesus washed the disciples' feet, and then he said to them, do you understand what I've done for you? I am your Lord and Master, and yet I have washed your feet. And so you must also wash one another's feet. greater love has no one than this, than he lay down his life for his friend. And I have called you my friend. And so now a new commandment I give you. Love one another as I have loved you. Jesus himself is making these statements. And the writer here is bringing it back to our attention. The characteristic that ought to be seen in churches that bear the name of Christ is this kind of self-giving, self-sacrificial love. Now, many of you will be aware that the Greek language has several words for love, and the word used in this context is that word agape, often referred to as unconditional love. This is the kind of love he's talking about. And it's important for us to grasp that because we so often get confused when it comes to love. What I mean by that is we tend to think of love as being something you can fall into or fall out of. But you actually cannot fall into agape or fall out of agape. Because love of that sort, though it might have an emotional component that accompanies it, is not something based on some kind of feeling that you have. Love in this way is not an emotion. It is not something that just causes your heart to flutter when your eyes meet across the room or something like that. If it was, how could Jesus command us to love that way? If the whole idea of love is this emotion you have first, which then causes you to do something for other people, how can that love be commanded? Like, if there's a person standing right here and I'm thinking, okay, I'm supposed to do what Jesus wants me to do. Jesus said I'm supposed to love that person. Okay, so if love's having this feeling, this warmth toward that person, and I want to obey Jesus' command, then I've got to make that happen. So I'm trying, right? You can tell on my face. I'm trying to generate a feeling for that person, but it's not happening because you can't make that happen. You cannot command such a thing. Agape, love in this way, is a deliberate action being done towards another person that is indeed loving, even if there's no feeling or emotion to go with it. This is what Jesus is calling us to. By extension, this is what the writer of 1 John is calling us to, saying this is critical, this is essential. And so he goes on to say, little children, let us love not in word or speech, but in truth and action. He says, look, everybody, it's not enough to raise awareness that we are supposed to love one another. I don't care how many bracelets you have on your wrist. I don't care how much money you give to the cause of telling people that they need to love one another. You need to actually do it. You can't just talk a good game. You can't just bring it up and say, this is what we have to aspire to. You need to be taking steps to do that. Let us not love just in word, but in action and in truth. So we hear that. And we go, okay, love like Jesus loved. He's willing to give up his life. Am I willing to give up my life for my brother or sister? I don't know. I guess I should try to be, but how am I going to fulfill that? How am I going to begin to accomplish that? Like, can there be anything more difficult than to say that's how I'm supposed to live? And you can imagine that it wouldn't be too terribly difficult to think, what hope do we have to actually pull that off? To actually live that kind of love all the time? Because agape love means doing these loving things even to people that you don't like. It means doing this kind of thing to people within your congregation that you don't get along with. Maybe you argue with. Maybe you just don't mesh. There's no exemption for doing this. It can be easy to think that, how am I supposed to live up to that? Well, thankfully, John understands that as well. And says, look, this working to love in truth and action, by this we will know that we are from the truth and will reassure our hearts before him whenever our hearts condemn us. Why would our hearts condemn us? Our hearts would condemn us because we know that we're supposed to do it that way, and yet we're all too aware of how we fall short in doing it that way. We are our own worst critic, right? Whatever it is that we're doing, somebody else might not even be aware that we made a mistake, but we know how we should have done it. I should have sung that note that way. I should have said it this way. I should have done it this way. And we can easily lament how we've missed the mark. Well, how much more then if we're wanting to fulfill Jesus' command in this way? And then we know how easy it is for us to drop the ball. I didn't love my brother or sister because I just didn't feel like hanging out with somebody today. I didn't want to give that money. I didn't want to take the time with them. And when we think about that, we can go, Lord, I did it again, didn't I? I blew it again. And we can have this risk of being led into a spiral of self-condemnation. You know, that's one of the things the church is often satirized about too, right? That we can start feeling immensely guilty because we're not living up to the commands of Jesus. And so you often hear about that, usually about Catholics, right? People will say, I grew up Catholic, I'm guilty all the time, right? You know, that's the joke that's made because of this kind of thing. But what's happening is John is trying to stave the keep us from leading into a place of always feeling guilty. That's what this move is that he's doing at this point. You see, he's not trying to say that it doesn't matter. He's not trying to say it's not important. He's not trying to say that it's possible to sin. He's not trying to say that it's not possible to sin. He's not trying to say that somehow you can just dispense with it. No. I mean, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. In the first chapter, he took great pains to explain, look, anybody who says that there's no such thing as sin is missing the mark. Anybody who says that they haven't sinned is making God out to be a liar. Anyone who says that sin doesn't matter is missing the point. Obviously, John takes this very, very seriously. But, he says, taking that seriously ought not now to lead you to a place of unceasing guilt because of what follows. We can have confidence before God whenever our hearts condemn us, for God is greater than our hearts. And he knows everything. If we are our own worst critics, because we know how we've fallen short, how much more then does God know precisely how we've missed the mark? I mean, God knows everything. And yet, when our hearts condemn us, God is greater than our hearts. The Apostle Paul has already said in Romans chapter 5 that where sin increased, grace increased all the more. The beautiful thing about knowing Christ and knowing God is that when we fall short, when we fail, when we drop the ball again and again, God's grace is present to forgive and restore so that we do not have to walk around with this feeling of guilt that I'm never good enough. John is saying that as we intend and seek to pursue love like this, as we take our steps, however small those steps are, as we begin that discipline day by day, week by week of living into that love, that is what he wants to see. And even if we're only 20% successful, he's saying, thank you for taking that step. That's exactly what I want you to grow into. But here's the beautiful thing, because this is a lifetime of living, as we continue to practice that agape love of following Jesus' command to love one another, it gets easier. We get better at it. Over time, we find ourselves able to be more generous, more caring, a little less selfish, all these things. It's something we grow into. Jesus is not expecting that we'll just hear his command and go, oh, okay, and then do it perfectly from here on. It's something we grow in. And see, this is a reflection of the love that Jesus has for us already. He is patient with us. He knows that we are mortal. He knows that we have weaknesses. Nevertheless, he gives us the command, but then also gives us the Spirit of Christ to empower us, to help us, to direct us, to encourage us. And all the while, as we are making that effort, he celebrates our successes. And when we fail, he's not standing there just saying, and you call yourself a Christian. John uses this powerful language for us to see how important it is But then he says, our loving God is there going, that's okay. Pick yourself up. You do better next time. Let's keep moving forward. And this is important. Jesus said, by this love that we have for one another, all people will know that we are Jesus' disciples. That's the characteristic that's supposed to be displayed. And so that is what we seek. That is what we pursue. That is what we work toward. Is it hard? Yeah. Is it something that we do perfectly? Never. But it's never meant to be something to cause us to be bearing down with guilt, weighing us down. Let us pursue this love for one another with the confidence of knowing that God is there, greater than our heart, encouraging us to carry on, pleased with every step that we make towards that. Let's take it to heart and with joy surrender to God's intention for us. Listen to Jesus' command and let this agape love be something evident in us and through us to each other.